Hi, so my name is Anne Hurlett, and I am going to follow up with the third and final learning community from this year and then talk about some lessons learned across all three learning communities, and then of course open it up for questions. So I would like to recognize my co-author Sarah Siegel, who was the lead for the Patient Family Center Care Learning Community, and Russ Martin, who led the evaluation. And again, I have nothing to disclose, and my opinions are my own. So what was the challenge? So the patient and family-centered care learning community looked at, first of all, what is patient and family-centered care? So it is an approach to healthcare delivery, and it's really grounded in these beneficial partnerships between the clinicians and the patients and families. So that is sort of the root of what patient and family-centered care is. And this really came into focus through the Affordable Care Act with the partnerships for patients, and that really supported this shift in healthcare delivery towards this patient clinician partnership. But the Partnerships for Patients program was drawing to a close, and some of the information that we are receiving is that hospitals really continue to struggle with implementing patient family-centered care because there wasn't really a clear way that it had been operationalized in the hospital setting. And so there was an interest, and this the Partnerships for Patients really was building the knowledge and understanding of patient and family-centered care in hospitals, but they were still continuing to struggle with what does that mean and how do we implement that in a hospital setting. And so from there, we decided to focus this third learning community on advancing the practice of patient and family-centered care in the hospital setting. And so that was our vision. We wanted to identify strategies from the Innovations Exchange that really operationalized patient family-centered care and helped these hospitals implement them in a meaningful way. And to do that, we have three aims that sort of operationalize this vision. So the first was to engage stakeholders in using evidence-based patient and family-centered care framework that really targets four areas. So leadership, patient and family partnerships, staff engagement, and performance improvement. And then the second was to assist hospitals in tailoring and implementing these strategies that we identified in the Innovations Exchange to advance the practice of patient and family-centered care, but really taking into consideration the organizational culture and the context of each of the hospitals that we are working with. And then the third was to achieve and document improvement in the processes and the outcome measures that were tailored to each of these strategies. So who did we have participating in our learning community? So we have 11 hospitals in Florida that participate, and they actually cover about 50% of the state's population. So about 10 million individuals are served by these 11 hospitals. And then for each hospital, we had a hospital team that was typically made of three. For some hospitals it was two, or they had more people join their team throughout the year. But they were really looking at having a diverse representation on our member team. So we looked for someone in a leadership position, some C-suite members, some quality improvement individuals. And then we really stressed that there should be a patient experience or a patient advocate or somebody who really represents the patient perspective on our team. And so the exact title of each person did vary hospital to hospital, but we really tried to capture these three areas on our hospital team. So what did we do? So we identified six innovations from the Innovations Exchange, so six different strategies that really operationalized patient and family-centered care in hospitals. And they sort of fell into two areas. So we had innovations that really looked at that patient and family partnership and how to improve the partnership at the clinician level. And so this was really that personal interaction level. When you're a patient or you're the family member of a patient in the hospital, how you're interacting with the system, with the clinicians at that individual level. The other really looked at the organizational level. So what strategies can be used to really improve patient and family centered care throughout the organization. So looking at the leadership and staff engagement, looking at organizational change and how that can really support patient and family centered care. We did have one innovation of the six that was required for implementation by all 11 hospitals, and that was to either develop or enhance an effective patient and family advisory program. So this was identified as sort of our mandatory strategy, and the reason we did that is because patient and family advisory programs have really been identified as a key process for improving patient and family centered care in hospitals. And so really what a patient and family advisor program does is it brings patients, current or former patients from the hospital, and they act as advisors. So they're brought on board and they serve in different capacities in the hospital. And it really varied hospital to hospital. So some were really involved in, at helping that personal relationship, so involved in patient rounding, for example. Some would review the discharge packets or hospital policies to give input from the patient perspective and really bring that perspective to the table. And so we focused in our first year really on that, developing or enhancing the patient and family advisor program. Some of the other strategies, just to give you an idea of what those other strategies were, reviewing all of your hospital policies and looking to make sure that the language was really patient and family centered. We had a patient notepad, which was an innovation that was very simple, but just having a notepad that had maybe questions for the patient, so when their doctor came by or maybe when the family members were there, they could write down their questions and so those could be answered. 24-hour patient access, or adopting a welcoming policy, so allowing patients and families to visit, families and friends to visit patients in the hospital at any time, any day, time of the day. So adopting a 24-hour visitation policy. Discharge classes, and there were others that developed over the course of the year as well. So how did we do this? Some of the things, as Maurice and Shannon already spoke about, we did as well. So monthly meetings, so bringing all 11 hospitals together for web-based meetings every month. And these typically focused on a topic. So at the beginning, really focused on what is a patient family advisor program? How do I implement this? How do you recruit? How do you, what kind of orientation do we do? Really, what kind of activity should they be involved in? And as the year progressed, we addressed some of the other strategies. So looking at that 24-hour access, what does that mean? And then as part of that, we would bring in outside experts, so people who could speak on the specific topic, as well as addressing some of the questions and challenges that our members were facing. So every month we did this. In addition, we had monthly coaching calls, which were individual calls with each hospital team. And we split those up among our team members. And so these were like troubleshooting, how are things going, checking in. We would gather some of our evaluation data during this time. But really, what is your challenge and how can we address that? We also developed our agendas through these coaching calls. So if everybody was really concerned about one topic, we were able to say, hey, we need to find somebody who can address this topic and really help everybody talk through this challenge right now. We also shared resources, and this played a really critical role for us in our learning community. So as somebody developed an orientation guide for their patient advisors, we shared those on a SharePoint site so that others were able to see samples as they were developing, so not everybody felt like they had to reinvent the wheel. We could share and adapt our resources appropriately across the learning community. We did have a number of partners, and our champion was Beb Johnson from the Institute for Patient and Family Centered Care. So she participated in our monthly meetings, she provided expert input, she really helped us get the learning community moving and plays a very critical role in our learning community. And we also had the support of the Florida Hospital Association, so we held our in-person meeting at the Florida Hospital Association and continue to receive ongoing support from them. So what are some of our results? So as I stated, the first and most important thing that we were doing was looking at patient and family advisor program. So when we started out, starting in October, we did an assessment of all of our hospitals just to see where they were at. And four of our hospitals had existing programs. So they had some type of patient advisor in the hospital in some capacity. And from those four hospitals, we had a total of 56 patient and family advisors. At the end of August, we did a follow-up evaluation, and as of September 1st, all 11 of our hospitals had patient and family advisor programs, so we met our goal, which was very exciting. And we almost doubled the number of patient advisors in these hospitals, so we had 111 patient advisors, and we've added more since then. So those programs are continuing to grow, which is very exciting. Some of the other things that we looked at, you know, we had other strategies, and as I alluded to, we also had a number of patient and family-centered strategies that hospitals adopted that were outside of those strategies that we had identified early in the year. And this was sort of a natural evolution of, you know, one hospital talking about something that they did and another hospital is interested in that and, you know, asked questions and said, hey, let's look at adopting that strategy. So I'm just going to highlight a few of those areas. So six of our hospitals have patient advisors that now participate in patient rounding. So when a rounding team is making their rounds through a different unit, a patient advisor will come in and assess the room, ask the patient, you know, are you comfortable? Is the temperature correct? Check the whiteboard and make sure everything is filled out the way it's supposed to be filled out. A big thing is minimizing the amount of medical jargon that they actually write on whiteboards so that if a family member comes in, they know exactly what's going on. So the patient advisor is participating in this rounding and really looking at things from the patient perspective. We have seven patient advisors that are now serving on committees or work groups that are focused on discharge and transition planning. And this is a big topic for us and something that we're really looking to tackle in this next year. We also have eight patient advisors who are serving on patient safety committees or work groups. Some more results. So we've made significant progress in adopting some of these strategies that we identified earlier in the year. So these are ones that came from the learning community, or from the Innovations Exchange, excuse me. And these were strategies that we had identified as ways to operationalize patient family center care. So four of our hospitals have adopted a 24-hour patient access policy. We have several more that are looking at doing that in the next year. This one's a little trickier. Policies can take a little bit longer to change. You really have to get that through multiple levels of approval and steps. So it's exciting that four have been able to do that. Five have implemented an evaluation of hospital processes or protocols. So that's, you know, reviewing your website, reviewing the language that are in your policies, and ensuring they really have patient and family-centered language. So that's the policies and protocols. And then five have developed staff training on patient and family center care. So ensuring that your staff understand patient and family center care, what does that look like? And also understanding the role of the patient advisor. So if a patient advisor is participating in patient rounding, what is the role for that patient advisor? Why are they there? And how can you best utilize them? We do have some anecdotal feedback on our learning community processes as well. So just highlighted a few of these things that we've collected. And we, again, collect this data through our coaching calls. We have evaluations after every meeting. We had an end of the year evaluation that we did in addition. So we try to collect as much information and anecdotal feedback as we can. So what are our lessons learned? So our learning community was really effective for looking at for the hospital-based setting. So some of our hospitals were further along in the process at the beginning. We had four that already had patient and family advisor programs, and they really were able to help those who were just starting out with the process. Like I talked about earlier, that resource sharing, you know, somebody already had a orientation guide that they could share. That was a really critical process. They were able to really collaborate and help each other through the challenges that they faced. One of the big lessons that we learned is that securing buy-in and support from the leadership was incredibly important. So if we're talking about changing policies or having additional having advisors, you know, walking around the floor freely, that takes approval, that takes buy-in from the leadership. But it's also critical that the staff that are interacting with patients and interacting with the advisors on a day-to-day basis also support patient and family center care, understand it, support the activities, and are able to live that day in and day out. So like Maurice and Shannon also talked about, context is incredibly important. So one innovation may have worked really well for one hospital and really isn't going to work in another hospital setting. This could be finances, it could be the organizational culture, it could be the timing. So really identifying those strategies that fit well and really thinking about your timing and thinking about, is this the right time to do this? Is this the best strategy for our hospital? Was incredibly important. And so having a cluster, having a selection of innovations that the hospitals could choose from was really effective for that because it allowed that flexibility. For the hospital setting and really for many healthcare settings, initiative overload is very important to understand. So there are a number of quality improvement projects, hospital-wide initiatives, it could be whatever month it is, something special is going on. So being conscious of that and knowing what the clinical staff are being told on a regular basis, what they're being asked to do, and making sure that we're not overloading the staff and having too many initiatives going on at once. So our next steps. So we're really looking at this past year and trying to learn from what we've been teaching and realizing that we need to add a patient and family advisor to our hospital team. The advisor really needs to be participating in the learning community. So we've asked each hospital team to identify a patient advisor who can join for those monthly meetings and the coaching calls and bring that information back to the other advisors and play a critical role in what should the hospital be doing next and what identifying new strategies that they can implement. And then we are looking at taking everything we learned from last year from implementing a patient and family advisory council and actually developing an orientation manual that will cover everything from how do you recruit to how do you actually get these advisors ready to go and onboarded. And this is compiling all these lessons learned across the 11 hospitals and bringing it together in a type of manual that can be shared with others who are interested in doing this. So now I'm going to switch gears just a little bit now that we talked about our three learning communities and just briefly touch on what we learned across all three of these sort of from a process level and then we will definitely open things up for questions. So we had this unique opportunity to look at these three very different learning communities and the experiences and the approaches that these learning communities took in implementing different strategies and see what was unique, what was a similar experience, and really learn from that and sort of take that back and refine the processes we're going. And so we, you know, started out with some of these similar approaches, but recognized that we were adopting very different innovations in very different settings with very different populations. And so we have to recognize that and really use that to our benefit. So WestDOT, we did a number of things to sort of track our progress. And one of the things we did was we really synthesized notes and materials from our operational side of things and tracked those lessons learned as we went along so that we could easily go back and say, oh, look at this. This is really interesting that all three learning communities had this similar experience. How can we refine that as we move forward? Or maybe it's something really unique and we want to note that for someone who may be interested in replicating this learning community in another place. So when we did this, we sort of have these five different buckets that we put things into. So lessons learned about recruiting participants, what was similar and what was different across our learning communities, really engaging them in the process, engaging our participants in the process. How do we overcome some of these implementation challenges? How do we measure how well we're doing and gather feedback? And then also, how are we going to retain and sustain learning communities moving forward, which is a very important question. So for this first part, getting things started and recruiting, you know, Shannon touched on this at the beginning, but it was really important to, one, make sure that the topic area really appealed to our participants and that it was something that was really, really important for them. So is patient and family-centered care important in these hospitals? You know, is that something that was important? And the answer needs to be yes. But also looking at those who are participating, are they ready to go? How can we best recruit individual or organizations, individuals to participate who are sort of primed and ready to go and really interested in this? So that was, we really leveraged those existing relationships that we had and leveraged the topics that were of most importance in that area to make sure that our learning communities were successful. Our champions in all three of our learning communities, our champions played an incredibly important role in cohesion within the community, but also in continuously moving us forward and progressing in our learning community. So having that champion who really understands the content, but also just has the ability to sort of rally the community and keep them moving forward and interested was just incredibly important and a really critical part of having a successful learning community. In the same way, the champion and also those who are facilitating the community really had to be flexible and changing course when needed. So was there something that came up that was unexpected, an unexpected challenge, or something that people are interested in that we really didn't know was a key issue? Was there, you know, a roadblock because of some legal matter that we weren't aware of? And so really having that flexibility to change, and then also addressing the strengths of the community. You know, what were our organizations, our participants bringing to the table, and how can we best leverage that? So really having flexibility when thinking about how this learning community is gonna continue to move forward. And early on, we really had to think about how we were going to sustain our innovations moving forward. So what we didn't want was our learning communities to end and the innovations then fizzle. So really thinking about how you sustain it moving forward. And that really has to do with the buy-in from the organizations and making sure that they believe this is important and that what we're asking them to do is feasible, it takes into consideration their context. So really, really thinking about sustainability from the beginning. So some of the things, I did touch on it's that we're really asking our participants to adopt strategies and make changes that are very important to them. And one of the reasons why the learning community really can be effective is that, you know, there's this peer support and mentoring. There are the organizations that are more advanced in what they're doing, and there are some that are newer to a topic, and they can really teach each other. They can share resources. When challenges arrive, they're able to brainstorm in a collaborative manner, and some of the creative solutions really came out of that space to do that, to share, to trust one another with your issues and challenges and really think of a creative solution that maybe they wouldn't have the space or the time or the energy to do outside of the learning community. There is something very much to be said for peer pressure and implementing and continuing to move forward and continuing to have the momentum. You know, if you know you're going to have a check-in every month and that everyone is going to ask how you're doing, there's something to be said for that accountability. I know we are all very responsive to accountability and to deadlines, so there's something to be said for that. So definitely not discounting that aspect of it as well. So that was a lot of information, and now we are going to open things up for questions that can be specific about our learning communities or just in general about our processes. So just jump in whenever you're ready.
So some of them is process, and each LC has their own metrics to some degree, but, you know, as far as how, like, capturing attendance at your LC meetings and making sure that the retention is the same, ensuring satisfaction, doing check-ins after each membership meeting, doing a evaluation of how that meeting go, did it meet your needs, doing, we each did a needs assessment at the beginning of the exchange to say, ask, what is it you want to learn and accomplish through participating in this LC? And then we did a follow-up at the year saying, did you reach this? What else can be done? Are there new things that have developed? So those have been our key, among, that's the thing that I've shared among all of us. Yes, yeah. We should have set measurable goals for each of them.
Yeah.
The group, yeah.
It was a collaborative process. The group was, you know, at least for the, I can speak for the emergency services learning community, we did some research related to measures in the area, and then we presented them to the learning community and had a discussion about what was feasible, what data collection systems did they have in place, and then from there decided what we could operationalize. And I just, to go back to the other questions, I wanted to note, our overall evaluation uses the Kirkpatrick four levels model. So we're, as Maurice mentioned, each learning community has identified individual process and outcomes measures. And then across the communities, we're also creating the reaction level, which is the participant engagement information and satisfaction with the learning community, which we're collecting through post-meeting evaluations and needs assessments. Whether those be conducted through online surveys or through phone calls and structured interviews. And then the other aspect is the learning aspect, which is the second level for the model. And this is really measuring if the learning communities, the learning community members are increasing their knowledge or is the learning community support structure addressing the needs that they've identified. So those are some of the, in addition to the behavior and results related to the process and outcomes measures, those are some of the other features that we're trying to measure. I think it's maybe also important to note that the evaluation aspect, we don't have a significant amount of funding as part of the project, so we can't undertake any data collection activities or analysis activities of our own. So we're really reliant on the organizations to track that information. And so it depends on what they're able to collect. And we just have to work with that. We don't have the capacity to do any of that as part of the project. So it's definitely been an ongoing exercise in trying to make sure that we are measuring success and evaluating the learning community, but then also not being able to necessarily evaluate as we would if, in the ideal scenario, if we could design the evaluation ourselves. So.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Sure, so the first question, if there are residents or physicians involved. So in some hospitals, yes. A number of hospitals involved through staff training. So we actually had one hospital that was, they put all of their residents through a patient and family-centered care sort of training where the advisors served as patients and the residents treated them, and they would be graded on how well related to communication, related to sort of all of these different interactions. So all of their residents were going through that right when they started their residency. So it was like, you know, August 1 or something like that. All the residents would go through that. So not every hospital did that, but there was and there continues to be a focus on really making sure that the clinicians and the staff who are really involved with patients are involved in this process as well. Second one was about resources, correct? So the resources, so the manual is something we're really focusing on this year, the orientation manual, and we'll be putting that together. And I'm not 100% sure what our, we'll be sharing it with our hospitals. I'm not sure if we'll be, what we'll be doing with it, but stay tuned for that. For some of the resources, so we have a SharePoint site where we share the resources, and that belongs to the learning community, so it's not open to the public. I think part of that is really building that trust among the hospitals. They're sharing their hospital policies and their internal documents, and there really had to be a lot of trust for them to be willing to share that. That said, a number of the resources that we shared did come from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, from the Institute for Patient and Family-Centered Care, and other organizations who had these tools and resources freely available. And as part of our research, we would, you know, if somebody was really interested in a topic, we would do research on the WestStat side and try to find tools and materials that would help our hospitals. So a lot of those resources are available publicly, and so definitely Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality and Institute for Patient and Family Centered Care have many, many resources free and available online. So I would definitely check that out.
That's something that's on our radar now. Having this information and being 1 year into the project, I think we're exploring ways to think about making that information publicly available and disseminating that information and really helping to identify these, you know, key lessons learned, especially because learning communities are collaborative, are becoming such an emphasized mechanism for quality improvement. So really trying to get out some, you know, nuts and bolts about how to implement and operate learning communities, so that's something that we think there's a great opportunity there, and we're starting to think through ways that we could share that information more broadly. So nothing yet from our perspective, but it's definitely something that's on our radar.
The MTM one, we are actually developing a guide, lessons learned guide, implementing an MTM ambulatory care settings, lessons learned from the MyRx experience, kind of case study guide that we're aiming to develop this year and hopefully have published in next year.
And my question about a database on collaborative.
None to my knowledge. We acknowledge there are many types of learning. Shannon said earlier, there's various ways people pitch this collaborative experiences, knowledge sharing. Everybody has their own term, and it all comes down to what is the reason for coming together, and what is the expectation from participating with each other. So whether you're coming together because you were all mandated to do something, and so you're just trying to learn from each other while you're doing it, and you were told by the agency that you need to have one, as opposed to something that's more voluntary, a bunch of people that have a shared interest and want to come together to develop a tool. And so it all depends on your purpose and your mission, but I haven't seen a collection of that anywhere. I would say looking at Academy Health, they have a listing of resources about learning communities. That's the most that I've seen. Academy Health, they have some work on learning communities that they are collaborative, however they determine that speaks to their work.
Also, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement has a nice framework for doing the quality improvement and some tools on their website. Especially, I'm thinking AIDS and just going through that learning collaborative process. And for some real life examples, based on IHI's the model for improvement, it is the National Institute for Children's Health
Quality.
Yeah,
the Vegas Plains Real Life example, like your own law collaborative. Kind of a follow up question with that. With your PCC, with the monthly call, did you have the teams all join on the monthly call, or was that kind of like a one on one or a team approach?
So the monthly, we had two separate things we did. We had a monthly web-based call that was a virtual meeting of all 11 hospitals, and they were focused on a topic typically. So, that might be early on, how do you orient patient family advisors, and we would have our champions speak about it, and we have a guest speaker. And then we also had every single month individual coaching calls. So that would be one member from the WebDAC team and the hospital, one hospital team that we would meet with. And that was just a 30-minute call, touch base, and typically the things are, what's going on, what's your priorities for this month, a few collecting some metrics each month, and then also like roadblocks, challenges, what do we need to be talking about. And that's sort of those coaching calls really help shape our agendas as well. And then we also had a core team that we would meet with, which was a couple representatives from a few of our hospitals. And that call would be after our coaching calls, and we would just sort of say like, hey, these were the issues presented this month. Here's what we're thinking for the agenda, and really get their feedback on developing our agendas for them, those full community meetings.
And did you give the teams opportunities to present to one another, like this is what we're working on?
Mm-hmm. So every month we really tried to facilitate discussion among our members. So it wasn't just we're presenting information, but here's your chance to talk about what's going on. We also had one meeting over the summer that was each hospital presented on where they were at on all across their strategies and just other things they were doing that might be patient family centered. We actually, we had people make connections outside the community. So we had two of our hospitals who visited another hospital to learn about their patient rounding because they were really interested in that. So they shadowed them for a day and spent a day. So there was definitely dialogue going on outside of the community as well.
Can I ask a question about
the patient advisors, it's a volunteer. So and for many of our hospitals, they actually recruited their first patient advisors through their volunteer pool because those volunteers were already sort of situated, but really recruiting them. This is another way that actually physicians and other clinicians were involved in the recruitment process, is they would recommend patients who maybe had not a great experience and sort of voice their opinion and bringing them on board as an advisor. So it was a volunteer position in all of our hospitals.
And we did not have patients from a board in our LC.
So, thinking of data and it's hard to detect improvement if you don't have access to the data. That's a really challenging piece. So, kudos to you guys for trying to find ways to measure it without actually being able to evaluate. With that said, how are you are you providing support to the teams for data collection? And then are they reporting back to you at all the data that they're collecting, or how are you managing them?
So for MTM, we've had internal meetings with both TSU and Spring Branch trying to understand what is it that can be actually achieved and agree upon that they can collect. And then we provided some thoughts of these are potential metrics that can be helpful based on what you're saying that you can provide, and have negotiate what can be really achieved on a nice monthly status of what they can report to us. So that's how we got to where we did with our work.
So it sounds like a complex
way,
right?
Because
you almost have to do 11 different plans for how many, hospitals or teams that you have.
Okay. I think one of the I think the underlying messages among all three is that it's a lot of hand-holding and a lot of touch points. You know, a lot of people just say, you know, at LC you have a monthly meeting and it's just providing the structure, but there's a lot of in between those meetings that need to happen. You need to make sure that they're still buying. You need to have communication. We each had newsletters to, you know, remind people this is what's happening. I'm doing check-ins, after-meeting evaluation. We don't know, making people feel that there is a community and not that we're just adapting things to them, but we're looking for constant input and how can we help you. And so if you have that message there, then you really establish the community and really get things going.
And has that inspired any of us to make changes in their data system or in their
Spring Branches, I know they're looking to figure out how to develop, get fields into the system to track that work. So they know that this is a challenge, and the uploading was in itself was a hurdle path. We're trying to get to that next hurdle for the coming future.
Yeah, and for the emergency service learning community, there's many complex issues, and I think worth commenting that one of the challenges, in addition to the data collection challenges, it's the data sharing, because we're working across the agency. So, for example, to know if an intervention has an effect on a patient's EMS utilization, you have to know, was the patient referred to this agency? Did this agency follow up with this person? Did that then have an impact on their EMS utilization? So that requires to say, okay, this person was referred to us to this agency, and then link that back to the EMS data. So it's very, it adds another layer of complexity. And then organizations, we have a few organizations that are involved in the referral and follow-up processes. So is organization A doing something differently than organization B that may impact the person's outcome? So we do provide support, and we actually developed we're refining a standardized data collection tool that all of the organizations that receive referrals will complete, which is our attempt to interject some sort of standardization that's going to help us follow the data then. But we're still working through the complexities, and some of it has implications for consent for EMS patients and who's allowed to see and access the data. So it's a very complicated process.
So with that, I think we have reached our time. If you have other questions, please feel free to talk to us individually. Thank you for coming and have a great conference.